No borders with a serious challenge. Tolerance and the futility of legislating morality. I'm hopeful that Europe can overcome the challenge of its new ethnic mix because of its proven track record for pluralism. While Europe has no shortage of closed-minded, knee-jerk opinions and racist, xenophobic political parties, most Europeans consider tolerance a virtue to be cultivated. At the leading edge of this thinking is the Netherlands. Historically, this corner of Europe saw some of the most devastating Catholics versus Protestants fighting in the religious wars following the Reformation. They learned to be inclusive, welcoming Jews when others wouldn't, and providing refuge to religious refugees such as our nation's pilgrim founders. And as a major maritime power during the Age of Discovery, the Netherlands became a gateway to Europe for emigrants and immigrants and their ideas to and from all over Asia, Africa, and the Americas. Based on lessons learned from their history, it seems the Dutch have made a conscious decision to tolerate alternative lifestyles. When I'm in the Dutch town of Haarlem, I'm struck by the harmony and compromise people have worked out between tradition and modernity, virtuous lives and hedonistic vices, affluence and simplicity. People live well, but in small apartments, getting around by bike and public transit. While the frugal Dutch may keep the same old one-speed bike forever, they bring home fresh flowers every day. The typical resident commutes by train to glassy skyscrapers to work for giant corporations in nearby office parks, but no skyscraper violates Haarlem's downtown cityscape, which is still dominated by elegant old gables and church spires. In Haarlem, the latest shopping malls hide behind Dutch Renaissance facades. Streets are clogged with cafe tables and beer drinkers. The cathedral towers over the market square with its carillon ringing out its cheery melody as police stroll in pairs, looking more like they're on a date than on duty. Two blocks behind the cathedral, a coffee shop, that's a business that openly sells marijuana, is filled with just the right music and a stoned clientele. People enjoying a particularly heavy strain of marijuana stare at their rolling papers as if those crinkly critters are alive. Others are mesmerized by the bubbles in their bongs. And, down by the canal, a fairy tale of cobbled lanes and charming houses gather around a quiet little church, creating a scene right out of a Vermeer painting. But this neighborhood is different. Lonely men, hands in pockets, stroll as they survey prostitutes who giggle and flirt from their red-lit windows. While the USA is inclined to legislate morality on issues such as prostitution, gay rights, and drugs, much of Europe takes a different approach. While countries differ, the general European sentiment is not to make a law forcing someone to be what the majority considers moral. A European would assume that every person is a moral person, but each individual has a slightly different morality. If one group gets to make their morality the law of the land, that infringes on another person's civil liberties. So, rather than attempt to legislate morality, European law tolerates immoral acts as long as they don't hurt someone else. For example, few on either side of the Atlantic would argue that prostitution is a good thing. But in most of Europe, where many people recognize that you can't just wish it away with platitudes or force it away by laws, prostitution is generally legal and regulated. Of course, each country has its own laws and quirks. German sex workers in Frankfurt rent rooms in multi-story Eros towers and essentially run their own businesses. If a Greek prostitute gets married, she must give up her license to sell sex. Portuguese call girls can lose custody of their children. Dutch hookers have a union. They get a license to practice their trade and are required to have medical checkups to be sure they're not passing sexually transmitted diseases. In Iceland and Switzerland, while prostitution is legal, it's illegal for a third party to profit from the sale of sex. In general, the hope is that when a prostitute needs help and pushes her emergency button, a policeman, rather than a pimp, comes to her rescue. While that's the ideal, it's not foolproof. There is still sex trafficking and abuse of women in the sex trade. But Europeans figure with their more progressive, creative, and pragmatic approach to what they consider a victimless crime, they are minimizing violence, reducing the spread of AIDS and other diseases, and allowing sex workers a better life, all while generating some additional tax revenue. Social scientists have a term for this approach: pragmatic harm reduction. In another example of European pragmatism, Europe's drinking age is typically lower than the United States. While no country in the world has a higher drinking age than America's, most European countries allow 16 or 18-year-olds to consume alcohol. European parents recognize that no matter how fiercely they moralize against alcohol, their teens will drink. Europeans puzzle over why 18-year-old Americans can marry, own a gun, go to war, and vote, but not buy a can of beer. Around the world, when kids graduate from high school, they party, get drunk, and some die on the roads. When traveling through Scandinavia in May and June, you'll see a creative solution to this problem. Truckloads of drunk high school graduates noisily enjoying a parent-sponsored bash. The parents hire a truck and provide a driver so none of the students need to drive. The kids decorate their party truck. Then the whooping and hollering grads parade through their towns from one family home to the next, where parents each host one stage of the progressive graduation kegger. Just about everyone gets drunk, but no one lies and no one dies. While this makes perfect sense to Scandinavian parents, it would be a tough sell for American parents. This is just one example of pragmatic harm reduction motivating drug policy in Europe. In some parts of Europe, a joint of marijuana causes about as much excitement as a can of beer. And the continent's needle junkies are dealt with by nurses, counselors, and maintenance clinics, rather than by cops, judges, and prisons. The European approach to drug policy is covered in much greater length later in Chapter 7. Perhaps Europe's inclination to be tolerant is rooted in the intolerance of its past. In the 16th century, they were burning Protestants for their beliefs. In the 17th century, they were drowning women who stepped out of line, condemning them as witches. In the 20th century, Nazis were gassing Jews, Roma, and gay people. Now, in the 21st century, Europe seems determined to get human rights, civil liberties, and tolerance issues right. And now, Europe legislates these issues rather than morality. While the U.S. is not likely to embrace tolerance with the sweeping idealism of some Europeans, just knowing that reasonable people endeavor to respect human diversity, promote inclusivity, and champion human rights to this degree can be empowering. Once back home, you have the option of tailoring your personal version of the American dream with similar ideals. European flesh and the American prude. On a lighter note, let's take a peek at Europe's relatively open relationship with their bodies and with sex. While not as high-minded as war and peace or taxation and social services, this is an aspect of the cultural divide that titillates any American traveler to Europe who's window-shopped a magazine kiosk, spun a postcard rack, gone to the beach or park on a sunny day, or channel-surfed broadcast TV in their hotel room late at night. Thinking through my recent travels, I recall many examples of Europe's different attitudes about sex. My Dutch friends had, on their coffee table, a graphic government-produced magazine promoting safe sex. I was sitting on the toilet at an airport in Poland, and the cleaning lady asked me to lift my legs up so she could sweep. I learned that I can measure the romantic appeal of scenic pullouts along Italy's Amalfi Coast Drive by how many used condoms litter the asphalt. Soap ads on huge billboards overlooking major city intersections in Belgium show lathered-up breasts. The logo of a German travel publisher is a traveler on a tropical paradise island, leaning up against its only palm tree, hands behind his head, reading a book that's supported by his erection. Preschoolers play naked in fountains in Norway. A busty porn star is elected to parliament in Italy. Copper-toned grandmothers in the south of France have no tan lines. The student tourist center in Copenhagen welcomes visitors with a bowl of free condoms. Accountants in Munich fold their suits neatly on the grass as every inch of their body soaks up the sun while taking a lunch break in the park while shocked American tourists are the ones riding their rental bikes into trees. And during a construction industry convention in Barcelona, locals laughed that they had to actually bus in extra sex workers from France. I'm not comfortable with all of this. I find the crude sexual postcards on racks all over the continent gross. That Benny Hill-style TNA that inundates TV throughout Mediterranean Europe, boorish. And the topless models strewn across page 3 of so many British newspapers, insulting to women. And I'll never forget the time I had to physically remove the TV from my children's hotel room in Austria after seeing a couple slamming away on Channel 7, and the hotelier looked at me like I was crazy. Compared to Europe, America is almost laughably shy about nudity. An early edition of my Art for Travelers guidebook featured a camera-toting David, full-frontal nudity, Michelangelo style, on the cover. My publisher's sales reps complained that in more conservative parts of the U.S., bookstores were uncomfortable stocking it. A fig leaf would help sales. But when it comes to great art, I don't like fig leaves. But I proposed just for fun that we put a peelable fig leaf on the cover so readers could choose whether they wanted their book with or without the nudity. My publisher said that would be too expensive. I offered to pay half the cost, 10 cents a book times 10,000. He went for it. I had the fun experience of writing for fig leaves on a $500 check. Perhaps that needless expense just bolstered my wish that Americans were more European in their comfort level with nakedness. The last time I was at a spa in Germany's Black Forest, in 1 2-hour stretch, I saw more penises than I'd seen in years. All were extremely relaxed, and I must say, I was struck by the variety. Getting Americans comfortable in the spas with naked Europeans has long been a challenge and a frustration for me as a guide. I care because once people get used to it, they almost unanimously consider it a great experience. My first European spa visit was with some German friends, a classy, good-looking young couple. I was swept into the changing area with no explanation, and suddenly, the Germans were naked. Eventually, I realized everyone was just there to relax. I eased up and got more comfortably naked. It's not sexual, simply open and free. Whether enjoying a German spa, a Finnish sauna, a Croatian beach, or a Turkish hammam, I can't come up with a British example. A fun part of travel can be getting naked with strangers. Of course, when producing public television, we can't easily show spas, saunas, or beaches in Europe where nudity is the norm. Even in an age where you can easily see anything, anytime on the internet, television standards and practices are rigid about showing nudity or sex, or even using forbidden sexual words, and penalties for violations can be severe. Any station airing anything potentially offensive on the public airwaves can be made to pay dearly if some of its viewers complain. Because of strict FCC regulations on nudity, we even have to be careful about which art we film for my public television show. Since I feature art that includes naked bodies, my shows are actually flagged by the network, and in some conservative markets, programmers play it safe by airing my shows only after 10 p.m., when things are less restrictive. As recently as the early 2000s, programmers actually got a list of how many seconds of marble penis and canvas breast were showing in each episode. They couldn't inflict a titillating Titian painting or a buxom Bernini statue on their viewership in more conservative communities without taking heat. As public broadcasting stations lack the financial resources to survive a major fine, they are particularly careful in this regard. Many of us who produce broadcasting material on a shoestring, like me and public broadcasting in general, have to ponder, should we put a digital fig leaf on David's full frontal nudity? Bleep Boccaccio's body language? Can I film the Three Graces only from the waist up? Will Raphael's Randy Cupids be labeled child pornography and Bernini's Rape of Persephone as S&M? My partners in public television and I proceed gingerly, not sure if we can show Venus's breasts. Can we risk the possibility of a $275,000 fine? And is that per nipple? You may not want to bring the more casual European approach to sex and the human body back home with you. And I'm not saying we should all run around naked. But I do suspect that children raised in America where sex is often considered dirty, are more likely to have an uncomfortable relationship with sex in their bodies than Europeans do. I sense that there is more violence associated with sex here than there. In fact, Americans report at least double the incidence of rape as citizens of most European countries. And I have a hunch that the French, who have as many words for a kiss as Eskimos have for snow, enjoy making love more than we Americans do. I like a continent where sexual misconduct won't doom a politician with anybody other than his family and friends. And where the human body is considered a divine work of art worth admiring openly. How Europeans view us. We've covered a lot of ground about how America perceives Europe. Now, let's flip things around and see how Europe perceives America. Americans, mindful of the old ugly American stereotype, tend to be conscientious ambassadors of their country when traveling abroad. And many are fearful that they might receive a negative welcome, especially in France, which has a reputation for being anti-American. Through my tour business, I take several thousand Americans to France every year. Each year, I survey them in an email, asking how their experience was with the locals. Even in times when the media was telling us how anti-American the world was, nobody complained. The French have always given American individuals a warm welcome, even if they don't care for our foreign policy. In Europe, the mark of a real friend is not someone who constantly fawns over your obvious strengths, but someone who tells you when you're off base and disappointing them. When European countries refuse to support U.S. foreign policy, many Americans say, "Hey, don't they remember how we saved them from the Nazis?" The answer is yes, absolutely they do. I was recently filming in France's Burgundy at a charming little mom-and-pop chateau. When I'm filming, get out of the way. The sun's going down and we've got work to do. But the aristocratic couple whose family had called that castle home for centuries insisted, "Wait a minute. We must stop and have a ceremony, because we have an American film crew here working in our castle." They cracked open a fine bottle of wine and brought out with great ceremony, as if it were a precious relic, a beautiful 48-star American flag. It was the very flag they had hoisted over their castle on that great day in 1944 when they were freed by American troops. They implored us, "Please, go home and tell your friends that we will never forget what America did for us, winning our freedom with its heroics, its economic and military might, and its commitment to liberty." In addition to being grateful to the U.S. for helping to free them from Hitler, Europeans also appreciate our defeat of the Soviet Union with a bold and determined battle of economic attrition during the Cold War. I have European friends 6 or 8 years older than me, born in the late 1940s, named Frankie and Johnny. Why? Because their parents were so inspired by the greatness of the Americans they met who came to liberate them from the Nazis. Particularly in times of political upheaval, people ask me, "Do Europeans judge us based on our current president?" While I've always found a warm, personal welcome, regardless of who's in the White House or which war we're currently fighting, the European view of America as a whole does rise and fall with their assessment of the current administration. Europeans are generally more liberal than Americans. During the Clinton years, the brand of America was soaring. With a womanizing, sax-playing, Europhile president who studied at Oxford, anything American sold, and California was always a hit. During the George W. Bush years, when speaking French was a political liability, America misled Europe into a regrettable invasion of Iraq, and the U.S. military tortured Muslims at its secret bases, the brand of America took a nosedive. European marketing firms combed anything American out of their advertising jingles. Then, with Obama, our brand was up again. In the early days of his presidency, Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, it seems, simply for liking the world. Many Europeans saw the America First election of Donald Trump as a sign that we'd become more ethnocentric again. Sadly, the dated ugly American outlook is almost national policy, and Yankee Doodle no longer sells. Many wonder how Americans are perceived during the Trump years. While Europeans understand far better than Americans do that oddball political figures sometimes rise to the top, they aren't used to seeing that in the U.S. They just can't fathom how someone who loses the popular vote by nearly 3 million people can still become president. And they may be a little confused because the cross-section of Americans they meet are travelers who tend to skew to the left. But at the end of the day, most Europeans will judge you by your own actions and not by your governments. I've found that Europeans consider it polite not to talk politics unless you break the ice. In other words, if you're a Trump supporter and don't want to get in an argument, just avoid the topic. Or if you enjoy a good debate, you've come to the right continent. And if you're a liberal and you want lots of friends, tell them what you think about Trump. For an American in Europe, two skills might be handy these days: an ability to explain how the Electoral College works and a good eye roll. Ultimately, Europeans are inclined to like Americans. But if there is a negative aspect to their image of us, it's that we're often loud, wasteful, ethnocentric, too informal, which can seem disrespectful, and a bit naive. As you travel, you may encounter what seem like strange European ways. Try to assume there is a rationale. For instance, many Italian hoteliers turn off the heat in spring and don't turn on the air conditioning until summer. The point is to conserve energy, and it's mandated by the Italian government. You could complain about being cold or hot, or bring a sweater in the winter, and in summer, be prepared to sweat a little like everyone else. While Europeans look bemusedly at some of our Yankee excesses and with concern at others, they nearly always afford us individual travelers all the warmth we deserve. We've taken a wide-ranging and, I hope, thought-provoking tour through the old world. You probably found some of these ideas appealing and others appalling. Again, I'll state the obvious. Europe doesn't have all the answers. But I wonder if Europe is out-innovating us when it comes to finding clever new solutions. When I encourage Americans to take a look at a European approach to a problem that's befuddling us, some critics accuse me of America bashing. If you love Europe so much, why don't you just move there? Short answer, I love America more. And because I care about our society, I challenge us to do better. In good times or bad, we should be open to considering all the solutions we can. And I find Europeans to be smart, happy, good at life, and people I enjoy learning from. Before traveling on to El Salvador, here are a few sidebars relating to the previous chapter. Is Brexit contagious? The rise of populism and nativism. I'm militantly optimistic when it comes to the European Union, but my confidence has been shaken by recent political events. In June of 2016, Britain voted yes on Brexit. If and when that vote is realized, Britain will become the first EU member to leave the Union, and a big, wealthy, powerful one at that. This event has the rest of Europe scrambling to figure out the state of a post-Brexit EU, and, in some countries, to ask whether they should head for the exit as well. The Brexit vote also threw into high relief several looming crises that have long vexed the EU. Some southern European states, Greece, Spain, Portugal, and Italy, have still not fully emerged from the nearly decade-long economic crisis. The expansion of the euro currency has stalled as Europeans face pressing questions about which countries have earned or lost the right to use the euro and how the currency should be managed to benefit all members fairly. Meanwhile, Europe's increased numbers of immigrants over the last generation, arguably necessary to keep Europe vital as its native population ages, has angered many Europeans. Europe is struggling to find a clear policy on handling refugees from nearby failed states and war zones. And many Euroskeptics are just fed up with what they see as ineffective EU bureaucracy gumming up their lives without improving them. As a frequent visitor, I see plenty of big improvements. But when you're an angry taxpayer, it's easy to ignore the positives. Reading this in late 2017, it's easy to draw parallels between Europe and the USA with our election of President Trump. In both places, I see a rise in anger against globalization, economic malaise, and a sense that immigrants are cutting in line ahead of the natives. And to be fair, the lives of working-class people, both in Europe and in the USA, have in many cases grown more difficult as the world has changed. I truly believe that these are good people motivated by fear of a changing world and love, wanting a prosperous future for their family. Trump, the pro-Brexit camp, and other nativist populist movements in Europe ingeniously tailor their messaging to this electorate, which has often been ignored by the political mainstream. And by playing fast and loose with facts and news, they've convinced these voters that they have all the answers. On the day after the Brexit vote, for example, some leaders of the pro-Brexit camp sheepishly admitted that some of their advertising had intentionally misled voters. The result, as I see it, is that these movements have convinced voters to willingly or unwittingly vote against their economic self-interest. Whether it's put the great back in Britain, a hunger for a more Hungarian Hungary, keep France white and French, or make America great again, the strategy is impressively consistent. Of course, Europe will survive. But will the European Union? The cost of policing the world. While it's easy for pacifists, at home and abroad, to grumble about the U.S. military, the reality is that we are the world's traffic cop. Americans pay with blood and money to protect victims of tyranny and to defend democracy and free enterprise all around the world. Defeating the USSR, saving people from genocide in Kosovo, and fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan and ISIS in the Middle East are expensive. Typically, the U.S. foots most of the bill, while Europe moves in with peacekeeping forces afterward. Or, as some people put it, the U.S. does the cooking and Europe does the dishes. Given America's unique world leadership position, our limited economic means, and the world's reliance on our military might, we need to choose our battles thoughtfully. There are cases where the world supports our involvement, places like Darfur, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, and places where they don't, like Central America and Iraq. Of course, we can do whatever we want, but it sure makes things easier on everybody when we wield our might with the support of our friends and allies. It's not unreasonable to say that Europe is not paying its fair share for its defense. Perhaps the EU wouldn't have so much money for its infrastructure if it had to do its own fighting. But consider the flip side. By their judgment, sinking money into their infrastructure rather than into their military is better for their long-term security. In the European view, America is trapped in an inescapable cycle to feed its military-industrial complex. As we bulk up our military, we look for opportunities to make use of it. As the saying goes, when your only tool is a hammer, you treat every problem like a nail. And then, when we employ our military unwisely, we create more enemies, which makes us feel the need to grow our military even more. If an American diplomat complained to his European counterpart, "America is doing all the heavy lifting when it comes to the military," the European might respond, "Well, you seem to be enjoying it. We're building roads and bridges instead." Traveling affords a good opportunity to consider how American military might has helped make our world a better place, and how it hasn't, and what kind of fiscal and military policies end up actually making a society stronger and safer. The EU spreads east. On May 1, 2004, 8 formerly communist nations joined the European Union, and suddenly the EU grew by 75 million people. In 2007 and 2013, 3 more additions boosted the population by another 35 million. In just a few short years, the geographical center of Europe shifted from Brussels to Prague. I remember visits to the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War. Back then, life was bleak, gray, and demoralizing because of ongoing political repression and their unresponsive Soviet-style command economy. Someone would dictate how many of these and how much of that would be produced, ignoring the basic laws of supply and demand. It was a fiasco. On my early visits to Poland, I remember that people lucky enough to own a car were taking their windshield wipers in with them at night. That's because the government underproduced wipers, demand exceeded supply, and the thieves knew it. They'd rip off someone's wipers at night and sell them for a fortune on the black market the next morning. Today, of course, the laws of supply and demand are kicking in. There are plenty of wipers produced and distributed to meet the demand, and people are leaving their wipers on their cars all night long in Warsaw. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, Eastern Europe began a dizzying transformation. In the 1990s, societies once forced to espouse Soviet economics embraced the capitalist work ethic with gusto, as if making up for lost time. While adjusting from the security of a totalitarian system to the insecurity of freedom, younger and better educated Eastern Europeans jumped at this opportunity to get ahead, working longer hours, having fewer children, and buying more cars. On the other hand, many older people missed the job security and sense of safety while walking down the streets that they remembered from the good old days. And many less educated younger people, who saw the new system working against them, joined angry and racist groups, such as Eastern Germany's skinheads. But those growing pains are largely in the past. Today, more than a quarter century after the Iron Curtain fell, freedom is old news, communism is a distant memory, and they have long since settled into the grind of capitalism. Even the notion of Eastern Europe feels dated. People in most countries we identify as Eastern Europe insist on being called Central Europeans, a name that's both politically and geographically more correct. But I still remember those old days, and for me, each visit to Eastern Europe is a case study in the fundamental wisdom of free enterprise, the laws of supply and demand, and how, when there's an incentive to produce more, there's also an incentive to work more and play less. The tyranny of the majority. Once, while riding the bus from Munich out to Dachau, I learned a lesson about the tyranny of the majority. En route to the infamous concentration camp memorial, I sat next to an old German woman. I smiled at her weakly, as if to say, "I don't hold your people's genocidal atrocities against you." She glanced at me and sneered down at my camera. Suddenly, surprising me with her crusty but fluent English, she ripped into me. "You tourists come here not to learn but to hate," she seethed. Pulling the loose skin down from a long-ago strong upper arm, she showed me a two-sided scar. "When I was a girl, a bullet cut straight through my arm," she said. "Another bullet killed my father. The war took many good people. My father ran a Gruskott shop." I was stunned by her rage, but I sensed desperation on her part to simply unload her story on one of the hordes of tourists who tramped daily through her hometown to ogle at an icon of the Holocaust. I asked, "What do you mean, a Gruskott shop?" She explained that in Bavaria, shopkeepers greet customers with a Gruskott. "May God greet you." During the Third Reich, it was safer to change to the Nazi greeting, Sieg Heil. It was a hard choice. Each shopkeeper had to make it. Everyone in Dachau knew which shops were Gruskott shops and which were Sieg Heil shops. Over time, there were fewer and fewer Gruskott shops. Pausing, as if to muster the energy for one last sentence, she stood up and said, "My father's shop was a Gruskott shop. To the very end." Then she stepped off the bus. Conflicts between the majority and the minority persist in today's Europe. Consider Northern Ireland, where the population is divided between Protestants, supporters of British rule, and Catholics, who identify with the Irish Republic. While the familiar Union Jack of the United Kingdom is the official flag of Northern Ireland, minority Catholics who'd like to see Ireland united see it as a symbol of oppression. Unfortunately, they no longer consider it their flag. In fact, many call it the butcher's apron instead. For a lesson in the power of symbolism in Ireland, visit a town where about two-thirds of the community is Protestant and one-third is Catholic. These towns can be decked out like a Union Jack fantasy, or nightmare if you happen to be Catholic. The curbs are painted red, white, and blue. Houses fly huge British flags. Streets lead under trellises, blotting out the sky with flapping Union Jacks. Not too long ago, many towns like these even came with the remains of a burned-out Catholic church. A Catholic walking down a street strewn with this British symbolism can only be quiet and accept it. To independence-minded Catholics, the Union Jack symbolizes not a united nation, but the tyranny of the majority. The result? There is no real unified flag of Northern Ireland. Until experiences like these in Germany and in Northern Ireland humanized the notion of tyranny of the majority, I never really grasped the sadness of a society where a majority rules mentality can, when taken to extremes, abuse a minority and bully it into silent submission. As the rhetoric for the Iraq War was ramping up in early 2003, a situation in Edmonds, my hometown north of Seattle, reminded me in some small way of what I'd seen abroad. This was a difficult and emotional time, considering all the patriotic fervor that comes with an invasion. Perhaps a third of our town opposed the war and two-thirds supported it. The Lions Club lined the streets of our town with American flags and declared they would stay there in support of our troops until they finished the job and came home in victory. While I supported our troops, I opposed the war. I believe that our president knowingly lied to get us there. When the Lions Club put up all those flags, which were normally reserved for patriotic holidays, I became very uncomfortable. I wanted to embrace my flag, but was put in a regrettable position that doing so would be tantamount to supporting the war. I felt as though my flag had been demoted from something that all Americans shared, regardless of their politics, to a promotional logo for a war I didn't believe in. I knew several fellow Edmonds merchants agreed that our stars and stripes had been kidnapped. In my relatively conservative town, they feared that not flying it would threaten their business. They felt frightened, intimidated. Their predicament reminded me of those German shopkeepers who had to stop saying Grüß Gott. And my own town reminded me of those red, white, and blue-drenched towns in Ulster. Although, to a far lesser degree, I felt that here in my hometown, a minority, of which I was a part, was also being oppressed by a tyranny of the majority. In defense of our flag, I had to act. I explained my concerns to the president of the Lions Club. He understood and agreed to have his club take down the flags after a week. It didn't happen. So, humming Yankee Doodle Dandy to myself, I marched through town and collected and carefully stowed away those flags. It was a small, symbolic, and perhaps overly righteous move on my part, but I was motivated by what I considered patriotic concerns. While some supported me, many were angry. I was shark bait on Seattle's right-wing radio talk shows for several days after that. But now, when my little town is a festival of stars and stripes on holidays like the 4th of July, President's Day, and Election Day, everybody can celebrate together. Because the flag flies for all of us, even the peaceniks. The German Spa. When I'm traveling, there are delightful road bumps in my intense research schedule where I put away the notes and simply enjoy the moment. The classic Friedrichsbad Spa in Germany's Baden-Baden is one of those fine little breaks. Ever since the Roman Emperor Caracalla soaked in the mineral waters of Baden-Baden about 2,000 years ago, that German spa town has welcomed those in need of a good soak. And it's always naked. In the 19th century, this was Germany's ultimate spa resort, and even today the name Baden-Baden is synonymous with relaxation in a land where the government still pays its overworked citizens to take a little spa time. I happened to be here when one of our tour groups was in town. I told the guide, who was German, that I was excited for this great opportunity for a Rick Steves group to enjoy the spa. She disagreed, saying, "No one's going. They can't handle the nudity. That's how it is with American visitors." They didn't know what they were missing. Wearing only the locker key strapped to my wrist, I began the ritual. I weighed myself, 92 kilos. The attendant led me under the industrial-strength shower, a torrential kickoff pounding my head and shoulders, obliterating the rest of the world. She then gave me slippers and a towel, ushering me into a dry heat room with fine wooden reclining chairs, their slats too hot without the towel. Staring up at exotic tiles of herons and palms, I cooked. After more hot rooms, punctuated with showers, came the massage. Like someone really drunk going for one more glass, I climbed gingerly onto the marble slab and lay belly up. The masseur held up two Brillo pad mitts, and he asked, "Hard or soft?" In the spirit of wild abandon, I said, "Hard," not certain what that would mean to my skin. I got the coarse Brillo pad scrub down. I was so soaped up, he had to hold my arms like a fisherman holds a salmon so I wouldn't slip away. With the tenderness of someone gutting a big fish, he scrubbed, chopped, bent, and generally tenderized me. In spite of the rough treatment, it was extremely relaxing. Finished with a Teutonic spank on the butt, I was sent off into the pools. Nude, without my glasses, and not speaking the language, I was gawky. On a sliding scale between Mr. Magoo and Woody Allen, I was everywhere. Steam rooms, cold plunges, it all led to the mixed section. This is where the Americans get really uptight. The parallel spa facilities intersect as both men and women share the finest three pools. Here, all are welcome to glide under exquisite domes in perfect silence like aristocratic swans. Germans are nonchalant, tuned into their bodies, and focused on solitary relaxation. Tourists are tentative, trying to be cool, but more aware of their nudity. The climax is the cold plunge. I'm not good with cold water, yet I absolutely love this. You must not wimp out on the cold plunge. Then an attendant escorted me into the quiet room and asked if I'd like to be awoken at any time. I told her at closing time. She wrapped me in hot sheets and a brown blanket. No, I wasn't wrapped. I was swaddled. I was warm, flat on my back among 20 hospital-type beds. Only one other bed was occupied. He seemed dead. I stared up at the ceiling, and some time later was jolted awake by my own snore. Leaving, I weighed myself again, 91 kilos. I had shed 2.2 pounds of sweat. It would have been even more if tension had mass. Stepping into the cool evening air, I was thankful my hotel was a level two-block stroll away. Like Gumby, flush and without momentum, I fell slow motion onto my down comforter, my head buried in a big, welcoming pillow. Wonderfully naked under my clothes, I could only think, "Ah, Baden-Baden." Chapter 4. Resurrection in El Salvador. There's something about visiting Central America that stirs a certain traveling soul. In my four trips to Central America, each organized and led by Augsburg College's Center for Global Education, have done much to shape my politics. It's fascinating how your impressions of a place, and that place itself, can evolve over many years of visits. My first trip, in 1988, took place during El Salvador's Civil War. By my second visit in 1991, the leftist People's Revolution had been put down, and the U.S. and corporate-friendly forces were in control. The third trip, in 2005, the primary focus of this chapter was built around the events memorializing the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Oscar Romero. And by my fourth trip in 2010, the revolutionaries were in power, but seemed only to be proving that power corrupts, and the people were still grappling with many of the same vexing problems. For each of these trips, I had a week or two available for a vacation. I could have enjoyed lying on a beach somewhere, but I chose to spend the time in El Salvador. Checking in on a people who lost a revolution, taking the pulse of corporate-led globalization in a poor country, collecting my impressions, and sharing them now, is precisely what I consider to be travel as a political act. I realize it's odd, as a relative novice to Latin American travel, for me to have such strong opinions, or any opinion, on these topics. Far from being an expert, I'm a classic case of someone knowing just enough to be dangerous. It's clear, my passion is rooted in the opportunities I've had to talk and learn from smart, impoverished people living in what I grew up considering were banana republics. Spending time with the poor in Central America, you find a wisdom, a dignity, and a humanity that radicalizes people from the rich world. I hope the following impressions and observations not only share some of what I learned, but illustrate why choosing a place like Managua over a place like Mazatlan next time you head south of the border can create a more fulfilling travel experience. Travel makes you wiser, but less happy. Back before my first trip to Central America in 1988, I specifically forbade my heart to get caught up in economic justice issues south of our border. I knew there were leftists fighting American-funded groups, and it was a tragic mess, but that was about it. There was too much pulling at me, and the competing sides, excuses, and complaints were all just too complex and contradictory. I just didn't have the energy to sort it out, and I didn't need it in my life. Then I traveled there and learned what Thomas Jefferson meant when he wrote that travel makes a person wiser but less happy. That first trip back in 1988 lit a fire in me. I realized I have the right, if not the responsibility, to form my opinions based on my own experience, even if it goes against the mainstream at home. It was liberating, empowering, and exhausting. After that first trip, I published my journal, flew to Washington, D.C., and spent 2 days hand-delivering it to the office of each member of Congress on Capitol Hill. Deep down, I knew my efforts would likely end up in congressional recycling bins, but I needed to do it, and it felt good. That little political mission marked the beginning of the time when my travels became more than just recreation. By the way, that journal and others from my Central American trips are online at ricksteves.com. In 2005, I returned to El Salvador for the first time since 1991. Landing in the capital city, San Salvador, I was met by my guide, Cesar, who whisked me away in his car. In his coin dish, I saw shiny Lincolns and Washingtons. I'm never very confident upon arrival in a new country, and this confused me. Cesar explained, "We've been dollarized now since 2001. America's coins had become El Salvador's local coins. In a kind of voluntary colonization, local elites chose to adopt the U.S. currency in order to avoid losing their personal fortunes in case of a radical change in their government. My hunch was that, since my last visit, much more had changed in El Salvador than just the currency. El Salvador politics line up on two sides. The left includes the FMLN guerrillas-turned-politicians, students, labor groups, Protestant churches, and many Catholic priests and nuns, especially those who espouse a liberation theology approach. The right includes the establishment Arena Party, the military, big business, wealthy elites, evangelical churches, and the official Catholic Church hierarchy. These two forces are locked in a seemingly endless battle for the souls of El Salvador's campesinos, or peasants. During its 20 years of rule, the Arena Party created a highly regressive tax code that strongly favored wealthy Salvadorans and international business. Traditionally, the U.S. has supported the right wing, both to protect its own economic interests and, back in the 1980s, to fight the perceived communist threat of the left. While the players remain the same, the game has changed. The peace that ended El Salvador's civil war also ushered in an era of globalization. By my 2005 visit, North American chains, from Pizza Hut to Texaco to Subway, appeared to be thriving. The Marlboro man looked good on his horse. And as I cruised through town past a can-can of American-owned franchises and a cheering squad of billboards, it seemed the victory of the U.S.-supported faction had been a huge success. And yet it was also immediately clear that living in San Salvador, a city of 1.5 million people, was still no picnic. El Salvador was running neck and neck with Honduras for the highest homicide rate of any country in the Western Hemisphere, and gang violence was rising steadily. Exploring San Salvador, it was clear that any nice home came with a fenced-in and fortified front yard. Rolls of razor wire were on sale in the newspaper. In the wealthy neighborhoods, each street had an armed guard. The relative lack of news about Latin America since the 1980s had lulled me into thinking that perhaps things were getting better for people there. But suffering that's not covered on the daily news is still suffering. This trip reminded me of the power of our media, even over those of us who are determined not to be misled. If the media chooses not to cover something, that issue becomes invisible, and its victims become mute. In a sense, silence is violence. Under a Corrugated Tin Roof with Beatrice. El Salvador provides the Norte Americano with a hot and muggy welcome. After one day, I had settled in quite well. I was speckled with bug bites and accustomed to my frail cold shower, noisy fan, and springy cot. I knew to brush my teeth with bottled water and to put used toilet paper in the waste basket to avoid clogging the plumbing. I was ready for some serious education, and I got it. I was shocked to learn how amazingly blind I was to people's daily reality just a short plane ride south of our border. Since my previous visit, Salvadorans had been dealt some miserable cards. When coffee prices crashed in the early 2000s, it sent the economy into a tailspin. Many desperate young people joined gangs, while well-off people built bigger and bigger walls around their property. Eventually, the maquiador industry, that's sewing clothing for rich world corporations in the case of El Salvador, moved in to provide jobs, but only after the government agreed to lower the minimum wage. By my 2005 visit, the minimum wage was about $1 an hour. While in the United States, minimum wage is considered a starting point, most Salvadorans aspire only to minimum wage, and that's all they get, $144 a month. To make ends meet, many Salvadoran families struggle to send one person abroad to earn money. These expatriates seek a menial labor job in the United States and send back what's called remittances. Nearly 20% of El Salvador's economy is money wired home from the United States. The remittances these laborers send home is common throughout the developing world. In fact, each year throughout the world, refugees working in rich countries send an estimated $500 billion to their families back home. But there's a huge cost to this phenomenon of the strongest, brightest young men leaving dangerous homelands with dead-end economies for work abroad. The home countries suffer an expensive brain drain. Half of El Salvador's university students aspire to leave their country. They see higher education as their ticket out. And while immigrants send home lots of money, the resulting broken families, poor single mothers trying to raise children alone, leaves a society ripe for the growth of street gangs. In 2001, two huge earthquakes destroyed or badly damaged a quarter of the private homes in El Salvador, leaving 1.5 million people homeless in a nation of about 6 million people. Of course, in a big shake, it's the poor whose homes crumble. Seismic safety is a luxury only the privileged can afford. An earthquake of about the same magnitude hit my hometown of Seattle that same year, and there was almost no damage. For protection, the most that shantytown residents can do is live in what they call miniskirt housing. Cinder blocks for the lower half of their walls, then light corrugated tin for the upper walls and roof. If a miniskirt house tumbles down, it won't kill you. And when it's over, you just scavenge a few 2x4s, reassemble the frame, and nail your sheets of tin back in place. Exploring the city's poor neighborhoods, I found myself in an urban world where it seemed that solid jobs were rare and half the workforce was in the informal economy, basically selling things on the street. In most of the old center of San Salvador, sidewalks are taken up by shanty retail stalls jammed against the walls of local businesses, forcing pedestrians to share the streets with cars. People with no disposable income entertain themselves creatively. I joined one gang of men gathered around a rustic checkerboard in a tiny park. There was no table. They were holding the board up together. It was a spirited game, using bottle caps turned either up or down for pieces. With the end of the game, I was invited to play the winner. It was fun, until my opponent got what they call a queen, and I learned that in Central American checkers, the queen has vastly more powerful moves than the king where I come from. With his Salvadoran queen on the rampage, I was swept from the checkered battlefield and finished in no time. My opponent gave me no mercy, and beating an American tourist that day is probably as vivid a memory for them as it is for me. I find it easier to connect with people in poor countries than in rich ones. Perhaps that's because when there's almost nothing to earn, time is not money. The key? A good traveler needs to take it upon himself to be the extrovert. In the midst of relative affluence, Americans seem to operate with a mindset of scarcity, focusing on what we don't have or what we might lose. Meanwhile, the Salvadorans I met who have so little embrace life with a mindset of abundance, thankful for the simple things they do have. I found Salvadorans extremely generous considering their tough economic reality. We dropped in on Beatrice and her daughter Veronica, who lived in a miniskirt shack on El Salvador's minimum wage. The place was as clean and inviting as a tin-roof shack with a dirt floor can be. Beatrice sat us down and told us of raising a family through a civil war. She said, "The war moved into the capital, and our little house happened to sit between the police headquarters and the guerrillas. At night, I hid with my children under the bed as bullets flew. For 10 years, the war put us in never-ending fear. Mothers feared the forced recruitment of our sons. Finally, we arranged a peace. But the peace accords didn't benefit us poor people." Beatrice explained how this peace was no more than an acknowledgement of the futility of a continued struggle. About her life, she said, "My house becomes a lake in the rainy season. Still, we're thankful to have this place. Our land was very cheap. We bought it from a man receiving death threats. He fled to America. While we make $144 a month in the city, the minimum out in the countryside is much less, only $70 a month. Nearly half the families in our country are living on $1 a day per person. To survive, you need a home that's already in your family. You have one light bulb, corn, and beans. That's about all. Living on minimum wage is more difficult now than it was before the war. Before, electricity cost about $1 a month. Water was provided. Today, electricity costs $19 a month and water is $14 a month. That's about a quarter of my monthly wage. My mother has a tumor in her head. There is no help possible. I have no money." Beatrice's strikingly beautiful 22-year-old daughter, Veronica, dreamed of going to the United States. But the coyote, as the guy who ferries refugees across Mexico and into the United States is called, would charge $6,000. And Veronica would probably be raped before reaching the U.S. border as a kind of extra fee. As a chicken with a bald neck pecked at my shoe, I surveyed the ingenious mix of mud, battered lumber, and corrugated tin that made up this house. It occurred to me that poverty erodes ethnic distinctions. Wherever you travel, there's something uniform about desperation. Beatrice and Veronica prepared for us their basic meal, a corn tortilla. As I ate a thick corn cake hot off the griddle, it felt like I was taking communion. In that tortilla were tales I'd heard of peasants who bundled their tortillas into a bandana and ran through the night as American helicopters swept across their skies. For me, munching on that tortilla provided a sense of solidarity, wimpy but still solidarity. I was what locals jokingly call a round-trip revolutionary, someone from a stable and wealthy country who cares enough to come down here, but only with a return ticket zipped safely into his money belt. Still, having had the opportunity to sit and talk with Beatrice and Veronica, even a round-trip revolutionary flies home with an indelible understanding of the human reality of that much-quoted statistic. Half of humanity is trying to live on $2 a day. Globalization, the ism of our time. Beatrice and Veronica and you and I are players in a vast global chess game of commerce. As the world's economy evolves, modern technology is shrinking the planet, putting the labor, natural resources, and capital of distant lands in touch with each other and revolutionizing the way products are made and distributed.